This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tonight, the Film Society of Lincoln Center honors Martin Scorsese at its annual gala tribute. Scorsese and his generation of filmmakers who shook up Hollywood in the 70s, directors like Coppola, De Palma, Spielberg, Altman, and Lucas, are the subject of the new book Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. My guest is the author Peter Biskind, who's former executive editor of Premiere magazine and former editor-in-chief of American Film. Biskind says that two movies in the late 60s, The Graduate and Bonnie and Clyde, paved the way for the films of the 70s. Here's Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway in a scene from the first part of Bonnie and Clyde shortly after they've hit the road together in a stolen car. Bonnie is trying to seduce Clyde, but he rejects her advances.
I might as well tell you right off. I ain't much of a lover boy. That don't mean nothing personal about you. I mean, I never saw no percentage in it. Ain't nothing wrong with me. I don't like boys.
Boy.
Huh? Boy, what?
Your advertising is just dandy. Folks never guess you don't have a thing to sell. You better take me home now.
Now, you wait.
Now, don't you touch me.
All right. If all you want's a stud service, you get on back to West Dallas and you stay there the rest of your life. You're worth more than that, a lot more than that, and you know it, and that's why you come along with me. You could find a lover boy on every damn corner in town. It don't make a damn to them whether you're waiting on tables or picking cotton, but it does make a damn to me.
Why?
Why? What you mean, why? Because you're different, that's why. You know, you're like me, you want different things. You got something better than being a waitress. You and me traveling together, we could cut a path clean across this state and Kansas and Missouri and Oklahoma, and everybody'd know about it. You listen to me, Miss Bonnie Parker. You listen to me. Now, how would you like to go walking in the dining room of the Dolphus Hotel in Dallas wearing a nice silk dress and have everybody waiting on you? Do you like that? Does that seem like a lot to ask? That ain't enough for you. You got a right to that.
You write in some detail about the making of Bonnie and Clyde, and you say that Robert Towne was a script doctor on the movie. He worked on the script for about 3 weeks during post-production.
Right.
What problems did Warren Beatty and director Arthur Penn think the script had?
Well, Penn just didn't really like the script. Well, Beatty loved the script, and Beatty, of course, bought the script and produced the movie, which was also unprecedented for an actor to produce a movie. Penn was apparently less enamored of the script than Beatty. One of the problems was there was a menage a trois between the Beatty character, Clyde Barrow, Bonnie, played by Faye Dunaway, and a character called C.W. Moss. Beatty and Dunaway, or Bonnie and Clyde, were romantically involved, but somehow Beatty couldn't get it together, you know, without C.W. Moss being present. So there was a suggestion there was a homosexual relationship between C.W. Moss and Clyde. Well, nobody could deal with this element in the script. Towne, Beatty, and Penn thought it was too much to ask of the audience that they accept a homosexual relationship as well as these people being bank robbers and killers.
They were afraid they'd lose the audience and the audience wouldn't
identify. Yeah, they were afraid. I mean, it was risky asking the audience at that time to identify with bank robbers and killers. And to throw in homosexuality into that mix, Penn and Towne and Beatty felt that was just too much and persuaded Benton and Newman to take it out.
So when they took out the homosexuality aspect of the screenplay, they put in impotence instead.
Exactly.
The Clyde Barrow, Warren Beatty character was impotent in it.
How that arose, I have no idea. That made him sexually dysfunctional. And it does work in the script, you know, and if you give the script a kind of, you know, give the movie a sort of Freudian cast to it.
Bonnie and Clyde is one of the films that you said is opening the way for other new directors and for a new kind of movie. Most of your book is about Martin Scorsese, Coppola, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Brian De Palma. Do you think that these directors were basically welcomed into Hollywood, or do you think they had to, like, bang the door down in order to get in?
Well, they definitely had to bang the door down in order to get in. I mean, it was a mixed bag because on the one hand, Hollywood was in a severe recession. The people running Hollywood Some of them were the old moguls who started the movie industry in the late 60s. For example, Adolf Zucker, who was around 92, was still sitting on the board of Paramount. Jack Warner's was still running Warner Brothers. So these guys were so out of touch that the movies they were making were doing really badly. So by the late 60s, the industry was in a very bad recession, and when Easy Rider kind of turned everything on its head, the sense was, oh, you know, these guys, there's a huge audience out there, a counterculture audience of young people. These guys know how to reach the audience. So on the one hand, they were sort of welcomed. You know, as Paul Schrader said, you know, anybody with a ponytail and a German Shepherd and a tie-dyed shirt could waltz into a studio and suggest anything. You know, the more outrageous, the better. But on the other hand, the old men who were running the studios hated these people. They were dirty. They had long hair. They walked around with bare feet. They couldn't stand to eat with them in the commissary. So it was very much a kind of approach of audience love-hate relationship. And some of these directors had to work very, very hard and hustle hard, you know, to get into the system.
Any themes you were able to find about how they broke in and how they got their training before getting there? I think one of the greatest film schools of the time was Roger Corman's studio. He'd hire inexperienced people to work cheap. That was one way of doing it.
Well, a lot of them went to film school, and the film schools were just really getting started in those days, and the sense of it was that you couldn't get there from here, that you went to film school, and if you were lucky, you made industrial films or maybe commercials or worked for the USIA. Another way, in some sense, a lot of the people who went to film school ended up going through Roger Corman's kind of exploitation factory. And Corman had an enormous impact because he would hire anybody, really, who was interested and showed the slightest gleam of talent. The Corman route helped a lot of people get hands-on training. Peter Fonda and Dennis Hopper worked for Corman. Corman also hired Scorsese to do Boxcar Bertha. He hired Coppola. He hired, a lot of those guys. Town wrote for Corman. He hired a lot of them.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Biskind, and his new book is called Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. One of the seminal films of the early 70s is Mean Streets, which has just been re-released, although in limited edition. I'm not sure how much of the country will have the opportunity of seeing the new release of Mean Streets. But Scorsese apparently had a fair amount of trouble getting this movie made. What were the obstacles he ran into?
Well, first of all, he didn't have any money. And, the financing was raised privately. And, you know, in those days, I mean, one of the remarkable things about the decade was that the studios were making these kinds of innovative movies. It wasn't like they were marginalized and relegated to one side the way they are now, where there are particular companies who specialize in these kinds of movies. But for somebody like Scorsese, straight out of film school, he did a little editing for Warner Brothers, but he really had very little entree into the system. He raised the money privately and shot the film on a rock-bottom budget under terrible conditions. Some of them, you know, he tells stories about how half a scene would be shot in L.A. and the other half a scene would be shot in New York, and they'd be spliced together. And he had a terrible time when the film was finished getting a studio to take it on. He took it around various studios. He got almost more or less kicked out of Paramount. And it wasn't until he took it to Warner Brothers, some of whose executives actually grew up in the neighborhood or near the neighborhood where the film was shot, that he got the film distributed. And of course, even when they did take the film on, it came out right around the time of The Exorcist, and Scorsese always felt that the studio did a poor job distributing it. The film never did very well when it came out, even though it got great reviews.
Yeah, even though every independent filmmaker has tried to remake it in their own image.
Right, exactly.
Scorsese desperately needed money to finish the film, and Corman offered him $150,000 toward the production, but there were strings attached. What did Corman want before he gave the money?
Yeah, Corman wanted to turn it into a black exploitation films were so-called black exploitation films were very popular in those days, and Corman said he would give him the money if he turned the whole film black. And of course, Scorsese refused because the film was about his own personal experiences growing up in Little Italy, and it would have ruined the movie.
And the backers for the movie wanted not Harvey Keitel in the starring role, but they wanted an already star, somebody who was already a star in the leading role. Who? What names were mentioned?
Well, essentially they wanted John Voight, who was very hot, coming off Midnight Cowboy and a few other movies at that point.
What are some of the other changes in the film industry that accompanied the new films as they came out? Changes in the studios, changes in theatrical distribution?
Well, there was a revolution in casting, which was enormously important. A whole new kind of actor came to Hollywood and routinely, became, people who normally would have been character actors at an earlier point became stars, as I said, like Hoffman and Pacino and De Niro. That's, Harvey Keitel. That's a very, Barbara Streisand, a very important change. And these are people who were, essentially ethnic actors who either looked Jewish, looked Italian, or whatever. So there was a rebel, and that was part and parcel of a kind of a refusal to use stars. The sense was that a star could be a debit for a movie instead of something of value. The sense was that if you put a star in a movie, people related to him as a star, whereas there was a hunger for realism in movies, for reality, partly because the reality that surrounded people in their daily lives was becoming so intense as a result of the struggle against the Vietnam War and so forth and so on, that, the riots in the streets, the plane jackings, the reality was kind of overwhelming the movies, and people wanted to see more reality in movies.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Peter Biskind, and he's the author of the new book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about the movies of the 70s. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Peter Biskind. He's the former executive editor of Premier Magazine and author of the new book, Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. In the beginning of your book, you quote Leonard Schrader, the screenwriter who's also the brother of screenwriter and director Paul Schrader. You quote Leonard Schrader as saying, "This group of people, the directors of the late 60s and early 70s, started to make really interesting films and then just took a big toboggan ride into the gutter. How did that ever happen?" Do you agree with that a lot of the really talented people who transformed Hollywood just self-destructed?
Yes, I do agree with that. I mean, I think it's one of the most interesting aspects of this whole era is how it ended, which is to say that a lot of these guys became very successful and very powerful at a very young age and essentially couldn't handle it. And, of course, you have to remember that this was the era, a big drug era. And a lot of them got very, very heavily into drugs and destroyed themselves in the process.
Who would you put in that category?
Well, a good example is Scorsese, who started doing cocaine during Taxi Driver, which was shot in 1975. I mean, Scorsese was a very bad asthmatic, and he had been taking drugs since he was a kid. He carried around an inhaler, and he took God knows what kinds of medications, all of which were prescription for his asthma. So it was no big deal. Drugs were no big deal for Scorsese, and he was an addictive personality, and he got heavily into drugs. And as he said himself, he had a death wish that he was pushing himself, pushing the envelope, in some sense, trying to see if he could kill himself. He felt that he was not going to live past 30, and in the late 70s, he was at Telluride, and apparently they had to score some coke at the festival because they ran out. They scored some bad coke, and when he got back to New York, he started bleeding all over the place from all his orifices and from his, skin and his nails, and went to the hospital and found that his platelet count had dropped precipitously and was told by the doctor in the emergency room that unless you get some transfusions immediately, you're going to drop dead. And it turned out that from some drug interaction of the coke with the drugs he was already taking for his asthma, he had an adverse reaction and he nearly died. And it was that sort of turned him around and made him realize that maybe this wasn't such a great idea.
And what movie did he come back with?
He came back with Raging Bull, and he, famously said that it finally made him. Raging Bull was not a movie that he wanted to make. He couldn't relate. He was not interested in boxing. He couldn't relate to Jake LaMotta, who was an awful person, and Scorsese, and who antagonized and alienated everyone around him. And Scorsese finally, after going through this near-death experience could finally relate to the LaMotta character and feel that LaMotta is me on the same, you know, to some degree I'm the same kind of person. I'm alienating the people who love me.
Your book is not only about the directors of the 70s who changed Hollywood, it's also about some of the producers who came in and changed Hollywood and then kind of changed it again. You talk about the new Paramount regime of Diller, Eisenberg, and Simpson and how that transformed Hollywood filmmaking. What year are we talking about here? Place us.
Well, there was a big change in 1975 where Evans and Peter Bard, who ran Paramount Production, left. The people who ran Warner Brothers, which was a very important, influential, hip studio in the early 70s, John Calley and Ted Ashley left. They came back eventually, but it was never quite the same. And also in 1975, Jaws came out, which had an enormous impact in terms of changing Hollywood for the worse, a lot of people feel. The studio suddenly realized there was a lot of money to make in movies, more money than they had ever made before. So they wanted every movie to be like Jaws and Star Wars, which created the so-called blockbuster syndrome. So they weren't interested in small movies like Taxi Driver anymore, even though Taxi Driver did quite well. So it became increasingly difficult for directors to make the kinds of small movies that the studios were eager to make in the early 70s. And getting the Paramount regime came up with this notion of high concept, which was essentially a TV idea. You know, one of the things that changed was they started putting a lot more money into TV advertising. Movies had to be able to be advertised in 15 or 30 second TV spots, which meant that the plot had to be summarizable in 15 seconds or 30 seconds, which was the high concept. You had to be able to boil a movie down to three or four sentences of, you know, 20 words each. And if you couldn't do that, they weren't interested in making the movie.
Peter Biskind, you are the former executive editor of Premiere Magazine, which is a movie magazine. I'm wondering what some of your frustrations were dealing in a magazine that is so dependent on celebrity journalism. I think a lot of celebrities really hate talking to the press. They're tired of telling their own life story. They don't want their personal lives investigated by the press, understandably. And so much of movie magazines are dependent on the celebrity profile. That's what is believed to, like, sell the magazine in the first place. So you have to do the celebrity profile with a celebrity who doesn't necessarily want to be profiled. They just want to sell their new movie. So what were some of your frustrations dealing with the kind of journalism that sells?
Well, you're right. It's very frustrating. There are very clear parameters about what you can say and what you can't say. And with Premiere, we always used to take, and we still do, take the high road, whereas our feeling was that a celebrity's personal life was off limits. We focused on celebrities' professional lives, and unless the personal life could be shown to be relevant to the professional life, to the movie, or the way the movie was made, we left it alone. But at the same time, you're right. I mean, how many times can you do a cover story on Tom Cruise? I mean, you end up rehearsing the same material over and over again, and it's very difficult to bring a fresh perspective or get fresh material into these stories when you've already done the same person three or four, five, six times. I mean, that was one of the reasons I was interested in writing this book, because people were much less guarded. The events of the 70s were 20 or 30 years ago. A lot of these people are no longer players, and they don't have much to lose. Plus, these were big egos, very charismatic, eccentric people who were much less guarded than they are now today. I mean, celebrities today are very, very careful and very fearful about bad publicity. But Coppola talking about the 70s and talking about the people he dealt with in the 70s was much less guarded than, say, Coppola talking about a movie he's making today.
Were you able to get the directors you write about in your new book to talk about themselves and to talk about the problems that they had with drugs and their own ego and the studios?
Yes, they were actually remarkably frank about it. As I said, for one thing, it makes a big difference if the book is not about a particular director. If you're writing about Scorsese, he gets very nervous. But if you're writing a book with about a whole decade, they know that the whole book is not about them, and that makes them a lot more relaxed. Secondly, as I said, it was a while ago. I mean, it's clear that a director like Spielberg, who's working consistently and has a very high profile, was much less eager to talk and much less frank than a director like Friedkin or Bogdanovich, whose career is not going well. As I said, they have much less to lose. at the same time, some of these feuds, which started in the 70s, you know, have very deep roots, and people still feel very strongly about them. They're as if they happened yesterday. I was quite surprised, for example, with the vehemence that somebody like David Geffen still hates Robert Towne. Robert Towne still hates David Geffen. Robert Towne is not speaking to Jack Nicholson or Warren Beatty or Robert Evans. Schrader still feels competitive with Scorsese and is willing to sort of bad-mouth him in a very, you know, surprising way. Or Spielberg and Schrader are not close. Or Coppola and Lucas, the competitiveness the two of them felt still manifests itself in what they have to say about each other. So I was quite surprised that some of these things that go back 20 or 30 years still bring fire to the mouths of the people who speak about them.
Well, Peter Biskind, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Fine. Thank you very much for asking me.
Peter Biskind is the author of Easy Riders, Raging Bulls, How the Sex, Drugs, and Rock and Roll Generation Saved Hollywood. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.